Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and the production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
It's highly possible that the most underrated composer in the history of music is still Joseph Haydn. There are literally thousands of underrated composers out there, and probably only a dozen and a half who are genuinely overrated. But at least in my opinion, the founder of modern music is Haydn, not Bach. I've written at least three or four long blog post essays nobody reads about how Bach's place in music is overvalued, and I really don't want to write a fifth. But there's something about Bach that, at least to me, if only me, is too heavenly, too divorced from the human experience, too, as we Jews say, goyish. When you get to know Mozart and Beethoven's music, they take on the quality of old friends. But when you get to know Bach, both the glory and the weakness of it is that it never stops being an extraordinary experience. The music's just too perfect. There's expression aplenty in Bach, but it's not human expression, it's the expression of divine beings. And these divine beings might feel compassion for our suffering, but they can't relate to it, and let's be honest, they rarely ever seem to relieve it. Furthermore, where's the humor in Bach? And most importantly, where's the fallibility? You can search far and wide for a compositional weakness in Bach, and you might find one every million measures. And that, as far as I'm concerned, is the ultimate compositional weakness. It's like music assembled by a kind of celestial computer coding. Bach was so masterful that through his counterpoint, he practically created the common harmonic language we use to this day. But this was entirely an accident. Very few composers knew more than a few pieces by Bach until Mendelssohn worked mightily to revive him in the 1830s to a fame Bach never had in his lifetime, and performed Bach with a seraphic beauty that was antithetical to the instruments and the performing style of Bach's period. The Bach of the Romantic period was a completely different composer. He was grounded in harmony rather than counterpoint. And as a personal interjection, when I hear Bach performed on original instruments, you know, rendered very little differently from a generically excellent composer of the Baroque period, I wonder if I understand why Bach's employers offered Bach's job to Telemann or Graupner before they offered it to him. Now, Bach's music is pure counterpoint and harmony. There's no flash. There isn't really even a style of which you can speak. There's only pure substance. And there's a musicologist, Jan Swafford, who put it like this: nobody ever wrote better notes than Bach. In the same way that Immanuel Kant is often considered pure analysis and thought and system that gives very little consideration to stylistic clarity or common wisdom for layman readers, in the same way the vast, vast majority of Bach is pure contrapuntal and harmonic thought that gives very little thought to instrumental color or to rhythm. And both were revolutions for the humanities that gave them something like the rigor of science, but for this pseudo-intellectual, both revolutions achieved something more rewarding when the successors turned this sort of soft science that both Bach and Kant invented back into art. Now, whether it was Bach who actually codified common practice tonality, or a combination of Bach, Handel, Vivaldi, Scarlatti, Rameau, Telemann, Pachelbel, Froberger, Graupner, Kuhnau, and who knows how many other composers, what is much less deniable is that Haydn was the one who first utilized how to use common practice tonality to the best effect. His symphonies, his string quartets, his piano trios, they're all sort of little dramas of harmony. They're platonic dialogues that are carried out in sound between two musical characters who propose ideas that seem to contradict each other in every way, but they work through every conceivable implication of their ideas until they can arrive at some kind of resolution. And some kind of synthesis, maybe even a livable compromise that allows life to go on, if you'll excuse the real-life metaphor. The symphony, Haydn's greatest contribution to the literature of the world, and arguably, I would argue at least, the greatest of all artistic contributions, because it's literally the only place in the world where philosophy and abstract thought has the demonstrable physical presence. It's about the continuity of life. It's about the pacification of the spirit. Now, maybe I'm too much a fundamentalist in this regard as a musician who loves symphonies and has listened to them almost literally his entire life, but having taught a course on the symphonies just recently, I'm more in awe of them than ever before. I believe that in a way that songs and operas and ballets never could, absolute music gives us a way of coping with life's vicissitudes. If Greek tragedy is a ritual that purges us of our emotional tensions and our repressions, then the grand symphonic tradition gives voice to those emotional tensions and repressions, which are too primal for us to attach words to. And when we hear them, we understand that there are dimensions out there where our anguish and our contradictions are understood and a place somewhere in the universe where they can be resolved. And knowing, as we do now, that there's a chance for some kind of resolution in some far-off place, whether it's heaven or somewhere in the elements of the universe or simply in the dimension of music, we're free to look at the dimensions of life with much more equanimity and solve our own personal problems without the weight of the unresolved passions bearing down on us. The problems of this world were never meant to be transcended, but thanks to music, we can direct the human urge to transcendence to the only dimension we know of where transcendence is truly possible. And the place where it's most possible is the symphony, and the transcendent possibility of the symphony begins with Haydn. That was the beginning of the third movement of Haydn's 44th symphony, the Trauer, or the Mourning with a U symphony, or Funeral Symphony, it's sometimes called. And it's a symphony of very personal meaning to me. And I believe that this is perhaps maybe even the singular place where transcendence really truly begins in absolute music in a way that is not only Christian, but is metaphysical in its totality. It's metaphysical in the sense that it takes in something that is a worldview that is larger than religion, something that is ultimately totally philosophical. But in order to get to the kind of transcendence that we get in the manner of so many later symphonies, when the symphony becomes like a battleground of diminished and minor keys against which major key happiness and triumph has to emerge transcendent, we first need the Haydn formula in which music is a conversation between light and darkness. So like in every high comedy, just to take the most obvious example from recent times, The Simpsons, every dark sentiment has to immediately be balanced with a light sentiment so that the darkness isn't taken too seriously. I can give you so many examples of that. Just think, I mean, the first one that comes to mind is the Sideshow Bob episode that's based on Cape Fear, when in order to make Sideshow Bob not threatening, inevitably something ridiculous and completely humiliating happens to Sideshow Bob every time he threatens the Simpsons.
Robert! If released, would you pose any threat to one Bart Simpson?
Bart Simpson? The spirited little scamp who twice foiled my evil schemes and sent me to this dank, urine-soaked hellhole?
We object to the term urine-soaked hellhole when you could have said pee-pee-soaked heckhole.
Cheerfully withdrawn.
Now, in such a world where the imagination can't allow itself to get too turbulent, though, it can't follow its imagination to its fullest extent. So it's inevitable that formula will creep in. Just think of The Simpsons after seasons 8 or 9. Now, in Haydn's case, his later Simpsons episodes came earlier in his career, when he was still figuring out how to make the symphonies into immortal masterworks. Some of them have innovations that are really and truly astonishing, but with a number of exceptions, don't assume that early Haydn is as interesting as a lot of musicologists want us to believe. There's no reason to start listening to, there's no reason to listen to all 104 and change Haydn symphonies. Just start by listening to the last 12, the London symphonies, 93 through 104, when Haydn polished that equanimity of expression and wit to an agility that seems to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. And then listen to the Paris symphonies, 82 through 87, which are meant as a grander statement for larger orchestra, a kind of maybe proto-Beethovenian, though Haydn obviously could have no way of knowing what was coming next in music history and that Beethoven was coming yet. He didn't know Beethoven until 1790. And then fill in the gap with the 5 symphonies in between, 88 through 92, which are fulfilled for other commissions and in some ways are the best of all. Many people feel that number 88 is the greatest of all Haydn symphonies, though for those who care, I'd put it in the top 5, with 92, the last of that series, and 3 of the Haydn London symphonies, 98, 100, and 103. And then finally, you can listen to the name symphonies. There are 29 Haydn symphonies that have names. Now, so far as I know, Haydn never gave any of his symphonies a name. But if a Haydn symphony has a name, that means that the symphony made an impression, enough of an impression on someone over the last 200 years and thought enough of it to call it something unique. Now, past there, there are a few worth getting to know, but as a homework assignment, I think that's more than enough, don't you? Now, Haydn, having capped his symphonic achievement with number 104, which is a perfect fusion of light and darkness, has nowhere else to take the symphony after 1795. Anything after Haydn 104 would be a formula. The symphony taking place both in a world of metaphysical abstraction and also pitched to an aristocratic audience of this world cannot at this time be heard to suffer unless the suffering is balanced evenly by joy. But the world itself was suffering in the Reign of Terror, obviously, after the French Revolution, in which roughly 40,000 people died with 20,000 sent to the guillotine, followed by the Vendée Rebellion, which may have killed 700,000 Frenchmen, along with all the various revolutions that make the total French Civil Wars from 1789 to 1801, in which a probable total of 1.4 million died. And then we follow that with 19 years of Napoleonic War, the highest estimate being that 6 million people died in those. Now, Haydn's symphonies had no way of coming to terms with a world in which so much bloodshed and suffering was so visible. But his choral music,
yeah.
Now, sacred music, particularly the Mass, is pitched to God and Christ and the Holy Ghost and the Virgin Mother, and is precisely about the transfiguration of suffering. What we just heard was the beginning of what we now call the Lord Nelson Mass, named for Britain's heroic admiral who lost his arm and then his life in the Napoleonic Wars. The Latin title is Missa in Angustias, or Mass for Anguished Times. It was written in 1798, and it can be seen as a sequel to Haydn's Mass of the year before, the Mass in Time of War, which begins in serenity and ends in terrible turmoil. The Mass for Anguished Times is consistently dark in a spirit that maybe no other of Haydn's voluminous works shares. Early in Haydn's career came the Sturm und Drang period, and while those works can get very, very dark, it's the kind of darkness you can mistake for an Italian Baroque composer like Vivaldi. It has a much more virtuosic, almost sort of erotic charge to it. The only real precedent for this is Mozart's unfinished Requiem and the hellish scenes in Don Giovanni. Even Mozart's 40th Symphony has nothing on this. 1798 is 7 years after Mozart's death. It's 5 years before Beethoven's Eroica. And at this point in history, Beethoven is still known far better as a pianist. And Austria, and perhaps the world, has only one verifiable musical genius at this moment to articulate the spirit of the times. And the spirit of the times were only getting darker. Now, the elderly Haydn was a seasoned traveler who'd spent a lot of time feted in England and France, but he was forever a loyal subject of the Austrian crown and the Holy Roman Empire without a subversive bone in his body. He was descended from Flemings and Croats, but the fate of Austria, the triumphs and its tragedies, were his. The Austria of his generation, ruled by Empress Maria Theresa, a deeply Catholic, conservative, and declining empire, depleted first by the War of the Austrian Succession in the 1740s, and then by Prussia's conquering of Silesia, the most profitable Austrian province, in 1756. And all this meant that Austria of its time, like so many declining powers, turned especially to culture because they have to find their pride in something other than political achievement. Now, thanks to Haydn, they found it in music. And while France, the most successfully absolute of all absolute monarchies, had been the dominant political power of the Western world and arguably of the whole world from the early 17th century until the mid-18th, they began a precipitous political decline in 1780 with the War of Austrian Succession, which was exploited brilliantly by Frederick the Great of Prussia, who acceded to the Prussian throne in exactly the same year. Now, as France became ever more decadent, her intellectual accomplishments only increased and the age of the encyclopedies began. Frederick the Great didn't want Prussia to be a great military power for its own sake. He wanted Prussia to be like France, not a new Sparta, but a new Athens, the center of thought and culture. And he wanted it to be a glory for its monarch, not only because its military power, but because of its intellectual prowess. Now, Frederick the Great achieved great political power very easily, but it took the German-speaking lands another 100 years to turn Frederick the Great's political capital into an intellectual achievement that excelled even France's, an achievement whose center was music and art, which France's Rococo period thought was generally very trivial and ornamental. But the very same political and intellectual achievements that propelled France to the center of the universe led it off a cliff. First into a generation, or maybe even 50 years of decadence, and then to a generation-long calamity. Now, a full lifetime, 99 years after the Napoleonic Wars ended, World War I began, and the very accomplishments of Germany and Austria, the two countries most known for the greatness of their culture, was what pushed them over the edge. After the unification of Germany in 1871 came 43 years, generation of decadence, up to 1914, and then 31 years, a whole generation of barbarism more cataclysmic than any the world had ever known and still has known unto this day. We in America are nearly a lifetime after that conclusion of that horrific generation, and the attainments of American deeds dwarf even 18th century France and 19th century Germany. Now, I don't need to tell you that after the Cold War ended in 89, America has grown ever more decadent politically, and no two people ever agree on what the country's priorities should be. And yet, while we grow farther apart politically and morally, our intellectual achievements are larger than ever before. It may not be a golden age for the humanities or culture. At least I certainly don't think so. And you can feel free to pillory me for that. But who could ever possibly deny that this is the golden age of technology and science? We've created the internet, of course, and we've created computers that currently process more than a quadrillion actions per second. We've invented hybrid automobiles and cars that don't run on oil aren't all that far behind. We can implant artificial memories, we can teleport protons, we can desalinate water, and we've mapped the entire human genome. We can give sight to the blind, put cameras into pills that map our innards painlessly. We can turn generic cells into stem cells that can generate into any body part at all. But the golden ages of France and Germany were precisely ended by their very greatest deeds. 18th century France believed that reason would enable us to solve our problems. Reason led them to the conclusion that all the world had to find was a better system of governing itself and the problems would cease, which led many of their children to ask, if there's a better system out there, why is nobody enacting it? 19th century Germany believed that culture would lead them to the deepest truths about the universe. Culture led them to the conclusion that by tending so conscientiously to their, admittedly, glorious culture, the Germans had found these deeper truths, and the reason no other country was finding these truths or tending so conscientiously to it was because they were incapable of having such a culture, which led many of their children to ask, if all these other countries are not capable of seeing the world as deeply as we do, doesn't that mean we deserve the world more than they do? Now, modern Americans believe that liberty will allow us to live our best possible lives. It's led us to the conclusion that we have only rights and no responsibilities to those around us whom we deem unworthy of our responsibility. And this may lead our children to ask, if people are unworthy of our responsibility, why don't we simply let them die? The world always has other plans, and the very qualities which propel civilizations to their greatest achievements also bring about their final apocalypse.
Thank you.
That was the beginning of the creation, 1790s evocation of primeval chaos that is both quaintly unlike chaos to our ears and is incredibly, eternally advanced for the 1790s, when in England Haydn was allowed to look through the telescope of the Royal Society, no doubt looked through at times by Robert Hooke, Edmund Halley, and Newton himself. The world suddenly was not only the perfectly monadized and mechanized best of all possible places, but a nebulous universe full of uncertainty principles and relativity, and maybe he realized that the world was more a reflection of the universe than his peasant-educated mind had ever allowed it to be. This chaos of the cosmos, the suffering it causes, the decline and the deprivation, that was surely something that Austrians of Haydn's generation knew extraordinarily intimately. Austrians were not taken in by the utopian delusions of the world being anything but what it was. And while France was in thrall at that point to Jean-Jacques Rousseau with his notion that man is born free and yet everywhere he is in chains, the German-speaking lands were in thrall to the still very young Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who wrote that what little freedom remains to humans so fills them with fear that they seek out any and every means to be rid of it. Rousseau yammers on and on about nature, but he believes in reason. Goethe yammers on and on about reason, but he believes in nature. And in the creation, Haydn seems to unite the two. Now listen to this nature painting, and when you do, try to remember that Haydn always tells you what the text is painted after he's painted the words with music, not before, because he sees in his mind and to the mind of listeners at that time, what it was painting was so obvious.
And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. Outrageous, dreadful storms now arise. The winds impelled are the clouds. By heaven's fire, the sky is inflamed. And awful roll the thunders on high. His command, rise from the floods, reviving showers of rain. The dreary, wasteful hail.
Later, Haydn sets animals too, lions, worms, gazelles. It's amazing stuff. So let's think about some history here. The year is 1796. Napoleon would not yet be first consul of the French Republic for another 3 years and not crown himself emperor of the French for another 8. But the decisive moment in the fortunes of the French Republic came in this year with the appointment of this semi-Italian soldier of fortune, not yet 30 years old, to be commander-in-chief of the French armies in Italy during the wars of the First Coalition. The war of the First Coalition is basically France alone against Great Britain, Prussia, the Holy Roman Empire, which means Austria at this point, Spain, and Holland, in addition to a few Italian city-states, all of which are terrified of the French Revolution spreading to their empires as they would be for another 120 years until even the upper classes were compelled by World War I to admit that the sovereign monarchy is not a viable option in the chaos of the modern world. In 1795, Napoleon prevents a coup d'etat in Paris with just a few garrisons. In 1796, Napoleon, now commander-in-chief of the French armies in Italy, marches his battalions all the way through Italy to meet with the French troops stationed in Tyrol, which is southern Austria, and then march on Vienna. In 1797, Napoleon seizes Mantua, and the 18,000 Austrian soldiers stationed there surrender. He then conquers the Republic of Venice, which had been a city-state for an unbroken 1,000 years. And as part of the peace treaty between France and Russia, they share control of Venice. Now, when Haydn began the creation in 1796, Austria was at war. When he finished it, Austria was at peace. But surely Haydn, like everybody else in Austria, knew that war was always a possibility. If the Ancien Régime could be laid waste in France, the most powerful state in the world, the establishment could be laid waste anywhere.
Disorder yields, and order, and order prevails. Disorder yields, disorder yields, and order.
The text Haydn really wanted to set was not the creation story, but some music for Milton's Paradise Lost. And I think you can hear the direction Haydn would go in that passage, where this angelic music yields to the demonic and back again in less than 2 minutes span. No matter how light or bright Haydn's creation is, it's still an awesome, terrifying work of Bosch or Blake-like art. Now, Haydn was no nobleman. And you can sort of hear, I think, the fallen angels cast down, as in Milton, through the kingdom of chaos down into hell permanently. That could be seen as a metaphor for what happened in the French Revolution, obviously. But Haydn was not one of them. He was the son of a wheelwright and a cook. And he was always thankful that his father lived to see his son become the chief court musician of one of the world's most resplendent princes. Now, Haydn made it in life in an exceedingly early age. But what about all the friends and family whom his success forced him to leave behind? If any of you have ever read Josef Hoth's The Radetzky March, which is about the decline of the Austrian Empire in the early 20th century, there is a heartbreaking mid-19th century scene between the newly ennobled Baron von Trotta, a war hero, and his father, who is a simple Slovenian soldier. And now that the Baron is a nobleman, the codes of honor prevent him from behaving like a peasant that he still was in his heart, or from sharing any of his true feelings with his father. They couldn't joke together, they couldn't reminisce, they couldn't show each other any of the love that was doubtlessly in their hearts. They had nothing left to say to each other, and they disappeared from each other's lives, both of them, into loneliness. Now, Haydn was generally a very cheerful man, and if his music is any indication, he was about as unneurotic as a genius ever was. But how could even he, the rock star of his time, who owed his success to the aristocracy, have looked at the French Revolution and not realized that the French Revolution fought for the dignity of his parents, his brothers and sisters, his boyhood friends, and all the people he loved before he knew the good fortune that would be his lot? He practically paid tribute to them in every symphony, which ostensibly contains courtly dances, but the peasant fever in Haydn's symphonies is everywhere. Just listen to the beginning of the finale of the 82nd symphony, also known as the Bear, because it's so supposedly it sounds like the awkward and no doubt cruel to our modern perceptions way that peasants make bears lurch back and forth as though they're dancing on two legs. Can't necessarily see in your mind the bear dancing more than in just that small drone at the beginning. I think you can definitely hear the peasant dancing. At times it sounds just a bit like a square dance or something like that. Now, on the other hand, Haydn seems to give these people whom the aristocrats see as crude, you know, these new men and women, you know, the kind that Rousseau wrote about in Emile, and he gives them a full dignity and honor that gives each of these human creatures created in the divine image a small piece of the divine right of kings, and they can claim equality and fraternity and liberty and life and the pursuit of happiness as their own.
Oh. Praise, hail, 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 praise, hail
that was the Adam and Eve duet from Creation towards the end, obviously with choral accompaniment, in which they give praise to God. Now, let's go back and just talk about this, both historically and metaphysically. Haydn's world was dying, and at the same time, his world was coming alive. Every employer ever to hire him was worried about losing his head right now. And yet, as the France-dominated world of absolute monarchy erupted in blood, there was a new world of bourgeois liberalism that began just a few short years after Haydn's death in 1809, when he was almost 77. After the Napoleonic Wars ended in 1815, there was no major power that emerged with more prosperity than Austria, who was already prudent and chastened by the living memories of defeat, and also from the dual revolutions of America, France, the world began the long process of liberation and equality for all those people who existed as the footstools of these aristocrats. And of course, that was millions and hundreds of millions and maybe even billions. Now, music is the art form of democracy. There is no understanding of language needed for music, either oral or written. All it takes is the ability to hear music, and it transcends every barrier of communication. It should not be surprising that in this long 19th century, marked by so many democratic revolutions, music that was loved by millions took on a complexity that is rarely seen in the mainstream of today's cultural discourse outside of technological developments. Creation is a poem unlimited, in which the entire universe is made present in all its manifestations. There's sublime church music crossed with street music. There's tragedy and comedy. There's the loftiest beings against the lowly men and still lower animals and plant life. We have no idea if the chaos before God said, let there be light in this particular piece of music was an eternal chaos or if there was an eternal return and a previous universe dissolved into chaos. I would probably say, however, that the creation posits eternal return, and it's the work of a society destroyed and then reborn. So let's now take this to the present day. How stand we in the revolutions of 2017? In the last 10 years, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, Me Too. Now make no mistake, these are revolutionary movements, and inevitably they provoke counter-revolutions, and I needn't tell you what those are either. Those who know me personally know that I've been very hard on these revolutionary movements and the people who subscribe to them. No doubt most friends would say too hard, and most family would say not hard enough. These are movements that agitate for revolution no less than Marxists agitated for revolution in the decades leading up to World War I. The entire establishment is terrified of them, and the more traction they gain, and there's no question they'll gain much, much more traction in the decades to come, the establishment will hit back. Big business, lobbyists, the 80% of legislators on all levels whom to varying extents are in their pockets, and of course the lower middle class who are their unwitting servants and soldiers. All of them are the forces of reaction. But for better or worse, I've come to realize that the universe is chaos. The universe is perpetual revolution. The revolution can't be prevented any more than counter-revolution. They go together like yin and yang. They define each other perpetually. And the more one gains power, the more the other inevitably does too. Our only hope, and it is a very small hope indeed, is to convince enough people that gradual reform is our best hope. Because in war and revolution, nobody is in control. Whatever you thought you were fighting for at the beginning, you're fighting for something extremely different at the end. The new created world that springs up at God's command will not be yours to enjoy. It may not even be your children or grandchildren who can lose their lives in the maelstrom just as easily as you can. It is for some abstract, meaningless to you, distant future person who can no more relate to your concerns than you can to the concerns of someone in 1796. But look around. Who can possibly deny that all these intersectionalists and critical theorists and neo-Marxists who believe in systemic cultural oppression the way that Marxists once believed in systemic class oppression are not almost completely legitimate in any point that actually matters? Even if it's absurd pseudoscience to say, as so many of them do, that everything is ideology and social conditioning, look at the inequalities of finance, of opportunity, of suffering, and dare to tell them that they have the same opportunities we do without feeling like a cretin. Just as happened under communism, I have no doubt that there will one day be nation states and empires like the Soviet Union that enact their critical theories as gospel and dogma, and the results will be disastrous to a point well past imagining. There will be states and empires like Germany who will rise in reaction and may perpetrate still greater horrors. But there will also be states like the United States and England and France and modern Germany who will be leavened and influenced by the insights of extremely sloppy and dangerous thinkers like Marx once was, and like Fanon and Said and Laura Mulvey and Judith Butler and Naomi Klein now, who have glimmers of genius that peek out amidst their charlatanry, just as Camille Paglia and Jordan Peterson do from the other side of the ideological spectrum. You don't have to be a good thinker to be a real thinker. But to be a bad thinker, you have to think in two dimensions rather than three. Even in two dimensions, you can have real insight and illustrate an entirely new and useful way of looking at a three-dimensional world. But to apply the insights of in anything but a three-dimensional context is a disaster every time it happens, and it always does. But just as the United States and those who followed suit found ways of incorporating social programs that took the best of socialism and communism while excising the dangerous elements, so will some countries one day find good ways of incorporating the best insights of social justice, intersectionality, deconstruction, hermeneutics, patriarchal studies, postcolonial studies, semiotics, mythopoetics, poststructuralism, and all those other mountains of bullshit, which, against my will, I must admit, have glimmers of true insight within their dangerous falsifications and may never have arisen had those of us in more powerful positions kept a more open heart, a more open mind, and a more open wallet. But in all these places, no matter how dark the world necessarily seems to go on, life goes on even if lives end prematurely, and in every place there will be light and dark, and amidst all the hopelessness there will be great hope. What the creation tells us is that being alive in all its infinite manifestation, in every minute of joy, in every longer minute of suffering, is the greatest of all possible gifts.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2017, AS21 Media, LLC, all rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?